From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The presidential primaries head into the big decisive states starting next week, and the Latino vote will be a major decisive part of it.
Today we will look at those less white states, well, coming up next Tuesday, and the very powerful voting bloc, the Latino vote, Harvest of Empire. We'll be talking to co-host Juan Gonzalez about his new book, A History of Latinos in America. Then, as the political protest continues around the Diallo verdict, there's also cultural protest. We'll be talking with a jazz musician who's put together a project, Music for Amadou Diallo. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Texas Governor George Bush and Arizona Senator John McCain turned their Republican hostilities toward the main event, Super Tuesday, after the Texas governor won the three-state primaries to capture the lead in the struggle for the Republican presidential nomination. They traded accusations of divisive low-road campaigning and posted rival victory forecasts for the climactic tests ahead. Saying he's not going to rest yet, Bush told ABC's Good Morning America that candidates like McCain, who use name-calling and accusations, get hurt at the polls. Vice President Al Gore rebuffed Bill Bradley's last-chance bid for headway in his faltering challenge before Democratic contests in 15 states next Tuesday that could decide who wins that nomination. Gore won overwhelmingly in Washington State's primary, gaining no delegates but denying his rival any basis on which to claim a boost in the next round. With an estimated 1 million people displaced by Mozambique's worst floods on record, helicopters and boats tried to save those still trapped today by high waters, while international donors delivered large amounts of emergency supplies. The latest official estimate is that 200 people have died in the floods that have devastated this impoverished Southeast African country of Mozambique of 19 million people since the beginning of February. But aid agencies expect the death toll to run into the thousands. Bodies are believed to be trapped inside huts or underwater. President Joaquim Chissano today urged the international community to provide more help. The death toll from 2 days of riots in southeast Nigeria rose above 400 today as troops patrolled potential flashpoints to prevent religious and ethnic bloodshed from spreading. Governors in northern Nigeria faced the task of explaining to their people why they had agreed to stop pursuing strict Islamic law, the main factor triggering an outbreak of violence that has raised questions over the future of Africa's most populous nation. Rioting flared in ethnic Igbo and Christian Aba this week in a backlash to the deaths of hundreds of people and clashes between Muslims and Christians last week in the northern city of Kaduna. A leading environmental group in Indonesia yesterday slammed former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger for urging Indonesia not to review business deals with the giant copper and mining company Freeport-McMoRan, Indonesia. The Indonesian Forum for the Environment, known as WALHI, said the statement was a form of intimidation against the Indonesian government, considering that Freeport, Indonesia, was accused of pollution in Irian Jaya, where the company is based. Emmy Heffield, the head of WALHI, said, "We strongly protest against Kissinger's statement because it sounds like intimidation. We think his statement is unethical, bullying, and ignores the democratization process now underway in the country." Kissinger is a member of the board of directors of Freeport-McMoRan's parent company that's based in Louisiana, Freeport-McMoRan Copper and Gold. Democrats have introduced resolutions in the House and Senate condemning Bob Jones University. That's the Christian school where Republican presidential candidate George W. Bush spoke before the South Carolina primary. University President Bob Jones III has an essay on the school's website that describes Roman Catholicism and Mormonism as, quote, cults which call themselves Christian. And the school bans interracial dating among students. Bush has expressed regret that he did not denounce the school's ideology at the time of his appearance. Congressional Republicans accused Democrats of partisan politics and vowed to keep the resolutions off the floor. Meanwhile, Reform Party presidential contender Pat Buchanan has come to George W. Bush's defense, saying he's being unfairly targeted in a religious war within the Republican Party. The former Republican presidential candidate said Bush has been unfairly criticized for his appearance at Bob Jones University. Speaking to students does not mean a person accepts the school's theological beliefs, Perot said. Pat Buchanan said. A scandal-plagued anti-gang unit of the Los Angeles Police Department routinely made up its own rules with no or little supervision. That's according to a 362-page LAPD report scheduled to be made public today. According to the Los Angeles Times and Daily News of Los Angeles, the report says there were plenty of red flags indicating corruption and abuses by police, but no one in authority seems to have noticed or dealt with the warning signs. Officers in the anti-gang unit are accused of beating, framing, and shooting innocent people. 20 police officers have been relieved of duty in the scandal. 40 convictions have been overturned due to tainted evidence, and scores of other cases are being reviewed. And that's some of the news at this hour.
Can I get a witness? Possession endless. We know you're guilty. Look at your skin. What? Nothing protects us. Ain't been no justice. No, you're a threat if you're blood African. Still tell the story. Give theirs the glory. You know the program. All blue is fam. As long as we under, our fault will suffer. There is no buffer. Just part of the plan.
Music from the Amadou Project, and we'll be going to its creator in a little while. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, to our listeners around the country. And George Bush apparently still trying to beat back the furor over his visit to Bob Jones University in South Carolina. He even wrote a letter to the Cardinal of New York, Cardinal O'Connor, expressing regret for the visit. Unfortunately, even that has been considered by many people a little opportunistic, since the Cardinal has been so ill of late. He's hardly working at all. And one of the other Catholic bishops here in New York, Bishop Daley of Brooklyn, responded, "Hey, Bob Jones is not that big a deal. What about your policy on executions? Why don't you do something about that?" So the Bishop of Brooklyn had a few words for George Bush.
And speaking of executions, Odell Barnes is scheduled to be executed tonight in Texas. And it goes to the case his lawyers are trying to bring around innocence. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But in a summary of other news this week, on Monday, some 350 protesters were arrested outside federal court buildings in Washington and San Francisco. Police arrested 185 people outside the Supreme Court, another 164 people outside the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco. These demonstrators were calling for an end to capital punishment and a new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal, the prisoner on death row in Pennsylvania, black journalist who was just on Democracy Now! On Monday, talking about the Diallo case, as well as his own and where it stands today. So these protests have not gotten a lot of attention in the mainstream media. That's a lot of numbers, 350 people.
Yes, and I'm sure it's going to continue to grow, because increasingly the public discontent in many sectors of American society with the continued use of the death penalty is beginning to come to the foreground.
And speaking of the death penalty, some call what happened to Amadou Diallo the unofficial death penalty. But there are many who are deeply, deeply disturbed by the verdict that came down in Albany, New York last week. And so people are boarding buses from New Jersey and New York and from other areas tomorrow, and they're heading to Washington, D.C., the Reverend Al Sharpton, as well as Harlem Congressmember Charles Rangel, will be going to the Justice Department to call for a review of the case, to call for the federal government to intervene and do what they did in the Rodney King case, and that is bring a federal civil rights prosecution.
Yes, although I don't think that my sense is that there's not going to be a lot of progress on that front in this particular case. I'm sure the Justice Department will look at it. But I doubt whether they're actually going to to take action on this particular case.
Juan, you wrote a very good piece in the Daily News yesterday. Carry wrong wallet, not on your life. And in a little while, I'm going to ask you to read a part of it. But before we do that, we're going to go now to Texas. But first, a related state, and that is Florida. Florida Governor Jeb Bush wants a former state Supreme Court justice to reveal the identities of inmates he believes may have been wrongly executed. Retired Justice Gerald Kogan, who served on the state's high court from 1986 to 1998, refused. He said that instead of interrogating him, Florida state officials should be trying to make sure inmates who say they're innocent get access to DNA evidence. And Kogan also says that the governor's office needs to start looking at the 84 cases nationwide where people have been released from death row because of DNA evidence. Well, the governor's request comes amid a decision by Illinois Governor George Ryan to put a moratorium on executions. Well, Jeb Bush's brother, Texas Governor George W. Bush, was recently asked if he would consider a death penalty moratorium in Texas. He's refused, claiming that the guilt of all death penalty cases that pass his desk has been proven. Well, tonight, another execution is scheduled in Texas. George Bush has presided over more executions than any governor in U.S. history. Odell Barnes is slated to die tonight, 6 o'clock, Texas time. And there are serious questions being raised about his murder conviction. We go now to his attorney, Mike Charlton. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, can you discuss the case? What is your case for innocence, and why now? Why in the hours before your client, Odell Barnes' execution?
Well, there are a number of questions about his guilt, the most profound of which relate to scientific testing, which demonstrated that the forensic evidence that was used to convict him was probably planted by the police. And the other forensic evidence indicated that most of the circumstances of the state's case against Odell Barnes were simply false.
If anyone were to just hear about the case in a sentence from the mainstream media, they would hear this. Odell Barnes was convicted on this evidence. It was a woman who was murdered. She was 42 years old. She had his semen in her. He had her blood on his pants, and there were fingerprints in the apartment. People would draw some pretty firm conclusions. Can you deal with those three points?
Certainly. The fingerprint issue, the state's evidence was that Mrs. Bass, the victim, had just purchased this lamp where the fingerprint was found, and that the lamp was used to hit her over the head to crush her skull. Therefore, because Odell's prints were found on that lamp, and she'd only had that lamp for a few days, therefore he had to have been there at the time of the murder. Actually, as it turned out, her son, Corey Bass, signed an affidavit for us that said that no, in fact, his mother had owned that lamp for a number of years, that Odell Barnes was a good friend of the family. He'd been in and out of her home many, many times. He had done repair work on her home, and his fingerprints could easily have been placed on there at a much, much earlier time, and probably were placed on there at a much, much earlier time. The semen, as it turned out, Odell Barnes had always insisted with his first lawyers, and really from day one of his arrest, that his relationship with Mrs. Bass was both consensual and intimate. That he did not rape her. Test on the semen, which were readily available and easily available to lawyers at the time of his trial, established that fact, that the intercourse had to have occurred hours, if not days, before her murder. It was unrelated to her murder, and that's what he'd always said, that two or three days before her murder that he had been to her house and that he had slept with her. The blood evidence that was found, the crime scene indicated that whoever committed the murder would probably have been covered with blood, and that's what the police told a judge in Wichita Falls when they asked for a search warrant for Odell's home. They found coveralls, which were not covered with blood, but which they said later had two dime-sized spots of blood on them. One of those spots of blood was later identified by DNA testing to belong to Mrs. Bass, and when we went back and did additional testing, we found out that it contained 40 times the level of citric acid that's normally found in the human body, and that level of citric acid is consistent with coming from a yellow top test tube. In other words, the police or someone in law enforcement took a test tube of the victim's blood and put some of that on Odell Barnes' coveralls.
And why would you think that they would want to do that?
Because at the time they did that, they didn't have a very strong case against Mr. Barnes. All they had were some witnesses who provided circumstances that were peripheral to the case that could go to establish guilt, but these witnesses were not very good witnesses. They were not very credible people. And so they needed some serology evidence, some sort of scientific or forensic evidence, which linked Odell to the crime. And I think that's why they did it. It was consistent with the way that they conducted their crime scene investigation, because that investigation was terribly, terribly sloppy. The police themselves have admitted to us later that they really did no real crime scene investigation, that they now use Odell Barnes' case as an example of how not to conduct a crime scene investigation. So they really had little or no forensic evidence which linked him to the crime, and I think they needed that blood to do it.
Now, in what county of Texas did this occur?
Wichita County.
In Wichita. And in his obviously he must have had appeals where some of these issues were reviewed by appellate courts.
No, in fact, he didn't. And that's really one of the reasons why Mr. Barnes' case is sort of symptomatic of our problem in Texas. We have for years argued that Texas death row inmates get little or no decent representation, and that was the case with Odell. His lawyers really conducted no investigation, and even though they were given the funds by the trial judge to do it, they hired nobody to analyze the scientific evidence. They really did no investigation for the witnesses. Had they done so, they would have been, I think, able to easily point the finger at the real culprits in the case. His appeal reflected very few issues that were raised at the trial. And then when it went into state habeas corpus, his lawyer at the state habeas corpus didn't do any investigation either, even though his investigator begged him to conduct a guilt-innocence investigation, that she was certain that she could prove that Odell was innocent. The lawyer basically told her, no, I think Odell's guilty, and we'll just go do something else. We're going to go on and focus on other issues. So that by the time that Gary Taylor, Phil Wishkamper, and I got involved in this case, all these other issues had been raised, and there was little or nothing left to do. I mean, they had basically left us with very few issues to raise. We largely did this guilt. The federal courts would not allow us to have the funds to do the investigation into guilt innocence, and we largely conducted that with assistance of the French citizenry.
We're talking to Mike Charlton, who's the attorney for Odell Barnes. Now, this case has gone international, Mike Charlton. The French Prime Minister, Jacques Chirac, contacted Governor Bush a few days ago asking for clemency for Odell. Why Chirac?
Well, the case has captured the imagination of the French people, and they have taken up Odell's cause very aggressively. I think they are, as with anyone who looks at Odell's case, outraged at the refusal of Texas courts to either provide a fair trial or to even take a serious look at the evidence that's been generated since then. Almost all the funds with which to investigate the case, to pay for investigators and scientific evidence or scientific inquiry, all of that came from French citizens, just in donations. And I think they're just outraged that it could go like this far without anyone taking a look at the evidence or seeming not to care.
So what happens? We're talking about a 9-hour period right now. What chances do you have? Yesterday, what, the parole board denied your last-minute appeal?
Right. We were denied by the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles 18-0. The Texas courts have refused to look at the evidence. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans has refused to look at the evidence. And now the case rests with the United States Supreme Court. They've got to either grant a stay or a stay of execution, or at 6 o'clock this evening, Odell Barnes will be executed, and he will be an innocent man executed for a crime that he did not commit.
And is there anything last minute you'll be doing?
No. I mean, I think all of the legal documents have been filed. We have gone to every agency that has the power to stop the execution. We've made all the arguments we can possibly make. We presented affidavits of witnesses. We presented the lab reports. We've done everything we possibly can, and we just have to hope that there is some judge that will listen to this case and decide that there's enough there to at least give him a hearing. It's where the evidence can be heard. And that's the sad part about it is that if all this evidence has been generated on behalf of Odell Barnes, no one will even give him a hearing to attempt to prove this.
Well, I want to thank you, Mike Charlton, for being with us, attorney for Odell Barnes, scheduled to die at 6 tonight. George Bush has said if there are any cases of innocence, he would look at them, but he thinks all people who he is signing death warrants for are guilty. Do you have George Bush's phone number?
Yes, it's area code 512-463-2000. And there's not much doubt if Mr. Barnes is executed that Governor Bush's claim about he's reviewed these cases is just simply false.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Again, the governor's number, that's George W. Bush, Republican presidential aspirant, is 512-463-2000. When we come back, we're going to look at primary politics. Super Tuesday is next week. And as these primaries move into less white states, we're going to look at the increasingly powerful Latino voting bloc with Juan Gonzalez. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Oh, by the way, welcome jazz into the world. Well, we'll be talking about music later, but I'm talking about jazz. It was music to my ears earlier this morning when I got a call that Jasper George Goodman was born to my brother David and my sister-in-law and dear friend Sue. We also have another birth to celebrate, and that is Sasha Lisa Scahill, born to Jeremy and Ivana. Jeremy Scahill was a reporter at Democracy Now! And former producer. So Jazz and Sasha, welcome.
Amy, that's a five times an aunt now you are?
An aunt, that's right. It's official. Juan also recently had a baby. How's Gabriella doing?
She's fine. She's fat and sassy right
How
now.
How old?
8 months. 8 months.
Well, I'm amazed you had the time for both having Gabriella and also giving birth to a book, because today it is all in the family, folks, as we talk about Juan Gonzalez's new book called Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America, particularly relevant today as we move into next week, Super Tuesday's primaries. Again, just a recap of what happened yesterday around the country in Virginia, North Dakota, Washington State. In Virginia, Bush had more than 350,000 votes. That's 53% versus McCain's 44%. Yes, Alan Keyes is still in the race at 3%. Virginia, it was an open-to-all primary, but Republicans cast two-thirds of the vote and rallied overwhelmingly to Bush, as they have in earlier contests. In North Dakota, with all districts reporting, Bush had 76% of the vote. That's more than close to 7,000 votes. And McCain had 1,700 votes, or 19%. Keyes had 5%. In Washington State, it looks like Bush had about 58%, McCain 38%, Keyes 2%. And then, of course, there was Bradley and Gore. Bradley, in the Democratic side, the former senator from New Jersey, spent 5 days in Washington state campaigning for at least a strong showing in the primary and a boost into next Tuesday. Instead, he suffered his fourth loss. Gore won 68% to Bradley's 31%. And he plans a five-minute national TV ad Thursday night on CBS. But even before the setback, there was speculation he might drop out, though his spokesperson denies it. That's what we have in the last day. And now there's next week, Super Tuesday. Major states where Latino voters could be decisive. In the next 2 weeks, on March 7th and March 14th, we're talking about states like California and New York. The following week, Texas and Florida. Actually, Juan, you'll be in a number of these states over the next few weeks as you go around being interviewed on your book. And I'm really thrilled to be able to talk to you about it today, Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America. Juan, talk about these voting blocks that have only recently begun to get attention. Talk about the Latino population in states like California and New York.
Well, it's not just in those states, amazingly enough, because some of the other states that will be voting also, for instance, next Tuesday are Connecticut, which has huge Latino populations in all the major cities of Connecticut, Massachusetts, which has a growing, fast-growing Latino population. You've also got Ohio, and of course, Texas and Florida on the 14th are the biggest in terms, second to California in terms of the large percentage of Latinos. But the amazing thing is, as I try to document in one chapter of my book on sort of a history of Latino political involvement since World War II, is that 50 years ago, the number of registered of Latino voters in this country was in the thousands. And today it's more than 6.5 million. And that 50 years ago, there were only a few hundred Latino elected officials at any level, anywhere around in the country. Today, there are more than 6,500. And still, it's a small percentage compared to the overall proportion of Latino population of the United States. But there has literally been an explosion of Latino, not just of the population, but of Latino voting power. So that you have a situation where, for the first time, you've got the two leading candidates of both parties for the nomination, Gore and Bush, like to boast about their ability to speak in Spanish. Although I understand Gore just turned down a request by Univision to do a full interview in Spanish. He said he used to be fluent, so I guess that he can only do it when he's rehearsed exactly what he's going to say beforehand. But I think more importantly, certainly in terms of the Republican strategy, it's clear that whether it's Bush or McCain, they've pretty much given up on the possibility of being able to make any dent into the African-American vote in the country. Certainly their failure to say anything about the Confederate flag in South Carolina, Bush's visit to Bob Jones University, emphasizes that even more. But there is this suspicion and this strategy that the Bush people keep pressing, that they can make significant inroads into the Latino vote in places like California and Texas and Florida, and thus recreate something that has only happened during the Reagan era, when Latinos voted for Reagan about 35% to 40%, as opposed to the normal 20% that they had for other Republican candidates. So they're basically hoping to make enough of a dent into this growing Latino vote to be able to build a kind of coalition that'll get them into power in November. The problem is that they first have to get there to the candidacy of the parties.
Juan Gonzalez, you know him as co-host on Democracy Now! He is a New York Daily News columnist here in the city where we broadcast from. He also has won numerous honors, including the 1998 George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism and the Hispanic Academy of Media Arts and Sciences Lifetime Achievement Award. He was born in Puerto Rico, grew up in a barrio housing project, and was co-founder in the 1960s of the Young Lords. Juan, you talk about the Latino voting bloc, but what's so powerful about your book is that you break down that Latino bloc or the populations around the country, and you talk about who Latinos are, where they come from.
Yeah, I think that clearly one of the difficulties that many people have had in trying to look at the Latino community is that there are so many different ethnic groups within the Latino community or national groups. And in the book, I try to deal not just with what we call the big three, which would be the Mexican-American, Puerto Rican, and Cuban American communities. But I also
Those are the largest populations?
Those are the largest. Yeah, basically, you're talking about the Mexican-American community represents about 60% of all the Latinos in the United States. So it's by far the largest. And then the Puerto Rican community comes next, and then the Cuban community. But the real story has been the fast-growing nature of the other Latino groups, Dominicans, Colombians, Nicaraguans, Salvadorans, Hondurans, and even folks from Peru and Ecuador, and the explosion of this multinational Latino presence in the United States is really a relatively new phenomena, basically dating from the 1980s, I document in the book, for instance, how at the beginning of the 1980s, there were fewer than 100,000 Salvadorans living in the United States, and by the end of the 1980s, there were close to a million. There had been a huge, huge population explosion of Salvadorans, as there was of Nicaraguans, largely as a result of the civil wars that were occurring in those countries at the time. And of course, the Dominican population in the East Coast of the United States has exploded significantly. So that I believe that it's very possible that when the new census, for instance, in New York City occurs, there will be almost as many Dominicans in New York as there are Puerto Ricans, and because of just the numbers of Dominicans that are coming every day. So, and one of the things I try to make clear, because people have say, well, if there's so many different nationalities, then they all have different political orientations, and they're very much like other European immigrants. But I think one of the things that happened with the massive Latino migrations after World War II was that Latinos didn't, because of the particular racial and linguistic history of the United States, Latinos did not become just another series of immigrants moving up the immigrant ladder, but they actually became a linguistic caste in the United States. Because what binds all of the different Latino groups together is that they all speak Spanish and therefore have much more of a cultural bond in between them than they do with the rest of the United States. And one of the things that's most important in terms of understanding U.S. history is that the linguistic history of the United States has been one that does not, that has attempted to stamp out diversity of language. To the point of view, for instance, that most of the major international, like the UN Declaration of Human Rights, most international law recognizes not just the right of a people to be free from discrimination on the basis of race or nationality, but also of language, whereas the courts in the United States have never recognized the right of people not to have discrimination based on language. So that what has happened is the United States courts have allowed linguistic discrimination to continue to occur in the country, and that has been felt by all Latinos, no matter what nationality they're from, and in its essence has bound them together in a way that they weren't even as close when they were in their own home countries, but in this country they've been thrust into this linguistic caste status. And so I attempt to look at that history and because people say, well, Latinos are a racial group, are they an ethnic group? Well, depending on the Latino group, there are people of all races within those groups, and some are more African than others, some are more Indian than others, but all have fallen into the linguistic caste structure of the United States. And I think that that has had an amazing impact in terms of, so that you find Cubans and Puerto Ricans who may disagree on a whole host of political issues, all agree that they suffer discrimination because of their language and culture in this country.
By the year 2050, just in 50 years, one out of every five U.S. residents will be of Hispanic origin. Juan, Amazon.com.
No, that's actually one out of every four.
One out of four.
Yes. The projections of the U.S. Census Bureau, the midterm projections, in other words, they're not the most dramatic, postulate that by 2050 there will be approximately 400 million Americans, right? And of those 400 million, 100 million will be Latino.
Well, I got the figure from Amazon.com, so I'll ask you if the second part is accurate. When they say a leading Hispanic journalist, and that's not for you to decide, but I agree, a leading Hispanic journalist, radical new perspective on the intertwined heritage of America and Americanos and how today's exploding Latino population in the United States is a direct result of our government's past policies toward Latin America. They're talking about your book, Harvest of Empire, History of Latinos in America. How does the reason people come to this country, and if it is a direct result of our government's past policies toward Latin America, shape Latinos' political view?
Yeah, that's one of the main thrusts of my book, I think separates it from the dozen or so books that have come out in the last decade looking at the Latino community, is that I believe that there is a direct relationship. If people ask, how come more than 50% of all of the immigrants to the United States since World War II have come from Latin America? Why is that? Why are so many Latinos in this country? You know, unless you go back to each of the major countries that supplied the Latino immigrant population and understand what was happening in those countries to force so many people to leave at once, then you won't really get a good understanding. And it's my thesis that the penetration of Latin America by American businessmen, military, and in the 19th century and the early 20th century, the deformation of the economies of those countries set the basis and actually created the mass migration. And that, for instance, you do not find large numbers of Argentinians in the United States. You do not find large numbers of Chileans in the United States. You do not find large numbers of Uruguayans in the United States. But the immigrants, the largest source of immigrants, Latino immigrants to this country, are precisely from those countries that were most dominated and controlled by the United States, the Caribbean Rim nations. And that's from all of Central America and Mexico, Colombia, and then the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and Cuba. That is the source. The most dominated countries are the ones that have produced the largest number of immigrants to the United States. And so, and I try to document how there was enormous attempt to create, to have Latinos satisfy labor needs. And much of the early migration was direct recruitment of companies that would try to get Latinos to come here to be able to provide labor. For instance, the Southern Pacific Railroad, and when it was building the railroads in the Southwest, contracted 16,000 Mexicans to come over to build the railroads. Henry Ford and the Ford Motor Company recruited thousands of people, of Mexicans, to come to Detroit. To Bethlehem Steel, for instance, recruited large numbers of Mexicans to go to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, to work in the steel mills. And there's a huge Mexican-descended population in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. That many of the small towns where you had where you have now these small out-of-the-way towns where you have huge Latino populations, Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, as an example, Vineland, New Jersey. You go Haverstraw, New York. All of these small towns that have huge Latino populations, most of them came as a result of direct labor contracting by farm interests. And now, for instance, you have this huge explosion of Latinos in the Midwest. To give you an example, in 1998, Latinos were an estimated 33% of the residents of Dalton, Georgia, 45% of Lexington, Nebraska, 40% of Dodge City, Kansas, right? These Midwestern states especially have huge Latino populations because the meatpacking industry has been, over the last 10 years, intensively recruiting Latinos to come and work basically in the two-tier wage structures that they've set up for many of these unions. So you have the older white workers in the meat plant still at the higher tier of wages, and now they've created low or basically minimum wage situations where they recruit basically Mexicans and others from other parts of the country, from other parts of Latin America, come and work in the meatpacking plants. So that what has happened in essence is this huge creation of a caste, a Latino caste status within the American labor movement, in large part directly recruited by the companies to come and work.
We're talking to Juan Gonzalez, and his new book is Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America. When we come back, I want to ask you about the Latinos in California and next week's Super Tuesday primary. And then we're going to look at the cultural response to the Amadou Diallo killing and the verdict and its aftermath. We'll be speaking with a musician and listening to some of his work. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with my co-host Juan Gonzalez, who is not a new author. This isn't his first book. He had a collection of his columns published as a book a couple of years ago called Roll Down Your Window, Stories of Forgotten America. And now his new book that has just been published by Viking Press is A History of Latinos in America. And Juan, we don't even have time to go back the centuries you go back. This is a very rich book, and I hope to continue this conversation on Friday when you're back, but on the issue of Latinos in California.
Yeah, well, California, of course, is the, at this point, is the mother state in terms of Latinos in America. So it's not only is it the largest state in the United States, it also has the largest Latino population. Close to about 30% of the population of California is Latino. And it will probably be the first state that is majority Latino in the United States. You've got an enormously varied population there, not only Mexican-American, which is by far the largest, but you have a huge Salvadoran population, Honduran population, also you have a there's always been a large Puerto Rican population in places like Hayward and Hayward, California, and in the Los Angeles area. Clearly, one of the big problems that the Republican Party has faced is that the anti-immigrant position of the early 90s had an enormous backfire. Because, you know, for instance, most Mexicans who came to this country never became citizens until about 1995, because most had the hope of eventually returning to Mexico. And so there was a very low naturalization rate among Mexicans. Something like 3 and out of 10 were actually becoming citizens. However, as a result of Proposition 187 and then, of course, the 1996 laws that the Republicans pushed to Congress, basically cutting off benefits even to legal immigrants, what happened is they forced all of these people who were in the country as legal residents but had never thought of becoming citizens. They had no choice but to become citizens if they wanted to continue being in the country. So what has happened since 1990, 5 has been an enormous rush to citizenship in the Latino community. And all of these folks basically scared to death that they were going to be ostracized or lose some benefits, ended up rushing to become citizens. You've had the largest push for citizenship in U.S. history in the last 3 or 4 years. And as a result, they all registered, and most of them registered as Democrats because they saw the Republicans as the people who were creating problems for their the quality of their lives. That's why Bill Clinton won such an enormous percentage of the Latino vote in 1996, and that's why the Republicans almost lost the House in the last midterm elections. And that's why the Republican Party, as represented by George Bush, has been seeking now to get away from that anti-immigrant image and try to recapture some of those Latinos, especially the more prosperous ones in places like California and Texas.
Well, Juan, we're going to wrap up this discussion now, but continue on Friday talking about Latinos in America in your new book, Harvest of Empire, as you talk about the roots, conquerors and victims, the image of America forms, the Spanish borderlands and the making of an empire, the banana republics and bonds taming the empire's backyard. You're getting a very good review in the New York Times Book Review this weekend, and we forgive you for that. But the criticism is that you find is you don't find too much good to say about the U.S.
Yes, that's what I've seen, and also that I'm too hard on the free trade policies of the United States.
And we'll talk about the effect they've had on Latinos in America. Juan Gonzalez's new book, Harvest of Empire, is published by Viking, and he's headed out to the West Coast, where we'll be co-hosting. He'll be co-hosting Democracy Now! From places like San Francisco, where you'll be on Monday, and then Houston and San Antonio on Tuesday and Wednesday. And by the way, folks, on our website, you'll be able to see where Juan will be speaking in different places. I'm very relieved, Juan, that in San Francisco, when you speak on, is it, what day?
That's Monday
on
night.
On Monday night, that you'll be speaking in a clean, well-lighted place.
Right, that's the name of the bookstore, yes. And we're all trying to stay out of the dim light these days, you know.
Speaking of which, this is a perfect segue into our last segment. You did a column yesterday on Amadou Diallo called Carry Wrong Wallet, Not on Your Life. Maybe you can read a little part of it before we introduce our next guest.
Yes. Well, the column starts out, I went shopping for a new wallet yesterday afternoon on Westchester Avenue in the Bronx. The old wallet was in fairly good condition, and I had become accustomed to the soft, worn leather in my pocket, but familiar or not, it had to go. It was, you see, a black wallet, much too dangerous to carry these days around the inner city. I stopped at Jack's Discount, which is a few blocks away from where Amadou Diallo once lived. Jack's is one of those places that sells everything from roach motels to living room sets, but not wallets. At a tiny stall outside, a young black man was hawking knit caps, gloves, and scarves. At the back of the stall were several small stacks of men's wallets. Let me see those, I said. $5, the young man said in an accent I couldn't quite place. The stack, however, was mostly black. Men's wallets have never been fashion statements. Any other colors? He pulled a lone dark brown from the bottom of one pile. I frowned. He plucked a dark blue from the bottom of another pile. No good, I said. You heard of Amadou Diallo? Amadou, he said. His words sounded like a war cry. I don't know from that. I pressed him for another color. From the bottom of the third pile, he snatched up two light tan ones with an ugly crown pattern and the word Marcas stamped all over them. That would have to do. Around the corner from Wheeler Avenue was Beeper Care Center. Black cell phones and black beepers are now another problem. Maria Martinez was standing behind thick plexiglass in the store talking to a customer. On display in the window were faceplates for cell phones. There was a lime green plate and a flaming orange plate and a pink neon plate. How much for those? I asked her. They're $15, $20, or $30. Depends on the phone and the brand of the plate, she said. Nokias are the most expensive. Some customers buy different ones to match what they're wearing. I asked about the beepers on display. They came in a dozen bright colors, even yellow. Same price in color or black, Martinez said. The kids prefer colors. Standard Telcom makes them. But the Motorola only come in black. They're top of the line. Don't need any color when you're on top. And then I go on to talk about the scene in front of Wheeler Avenue and all the people that were coming in to leave flowers in the building, in the vestibule where Amadou Diallo was shot. And say at 1.4 elderly black women got out of a car. "Would you look at how small it is," said Madge Smith, one of the four. She'd come all the way from Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn. "How can you fire 41 shots in that tiny space?" Smith said. "Those jurors should have come here and seen for themselves. The poor man couldn't run anywhere." They came and went all day, the anger and the hurt so deep many could not talk. So then I go on to talk about some of the other people who went there. And finally, I end the column saying, "Those who expected rioting this weekend ended up relieved that only protest ensued. They do not understand the greatest fallout from Amadou's death. In the black and brown neighborhoods of this city, even among many whites, the faith no longer exists that ordinary citizens and police will be judged the same way by our legal system."
And that's Juan Gonzalez in the New York Daily News. And you can go to our website at www.democracynow.org, which links to Juan's columns. Amadou, sung by Rich Medina, Rag Addis, Don Blackman, Carla Cook, Weldon Irvine, and Kadiadu Diallo, at least a clip of Amadou's mother in this piece. It is the first on a CD called The Price of Freedom, The Amadou Project. That's right. As in Philadelphia yesterday, 75 protesters angry about the acquittal of the New York City police officers in the shooting death of Amadou Diallo scuffled with police and blocked rush hour traffic. And as thousands marched in New York this weekend, scores of people arrested. And as hundreds are going down to Washington tomorrow to the Justice Department to demand a federal investigation and a federal civil rights case brought against the four police officers who were acquitted, others have decided to make a statement through artistic expression. Weldon Irvine is with us. He's a composer, lyricist, musical director, and arranger. He produced this CD, The Amadou Project, which is a collection of songs dedicated to Amadou Diallo. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Weldon Irvine.
Thank you for having me here. My pleasure.
Tell us about the day you heard about the death of Amadou Diallo.
Yes, it was last year. The date was February 5th, and he was on the front page of the paper that Juan writes for the Daily News. I saw his picture in the big caption, 41 shots. I read and reread the whole piece and was incensed as are they who are protesting now. But I decided to keep myself within the confines of my own home. Didn't trust myself to go in the street. I was very, very vexed. And I made my expressions manifest through a poem, which was rather lengthy. At the time, I vented everything I felt about Amadou's death, about the killing of black people in this country since day one. And I called the Amsterdam News requesting that they would look at it, perhaps publish it. They stated that they did not do poetry in general, particularly long poetry. So I thanked them very much. I wrote 5 more poems, 10 more poems, and then the musical muse hit. And I said, wait a minute, I'm a musician. I think I'll make it songs. And so the end result was, after 5 months, I completed the Amadou Project, which is the collaboration of myself and many stellar poets, musicians, and singers.
Y'all, why are we typecast into all of this madness? Humanity, ain't you tired? Ghetto child, ain't you tired? Universe, ain't you tired? Let's speak. Let's speak on it. Y'all, why are we typecast into all of this madness? Humanity, ain't you tired?
Yo, I keep a smile on my face even when it's looking very grim. I think about them babies innocent like cherubim. I'm living in an era when there is more black people owning things than there's ever been in America. From small banks to big labels, property and businesses, even stations on cable. Still we not able to control the money. And swine still on the table in ghettos across the country. Our babies stay hungry, but we got black senators in Congress. That's the illusion of progress. Getting hype when you see blacks on TV is plain dumb. When them cats still don't understand where they came from. Let's get everybody's head nodding to the same drum. Then have conversations that cross generations. It's then and only then.
That's Black Star and Q-Tip, Make It All Better. Our guest is Masterwell. That's right. Our guest is Weldon Irvine, who's put together the Amadou Project.
What's been the reaction? How long has it been out now?
Actually, it hasn't been out proper. It's independently released, and I didn't think that any of the Warner Brothers or Columbias would be beating a path to my door to release it, so it's self-distributed. But the reaction since the trial has been quite accelerated. I completed it back in July of last year, but now I'm getting quite a few requests.
I have to say that we've been playing parts of it on Democracy Now! A nun called from California yesterday saying, how do I get that hip-hop piece? If people do want to get this, since it's not your standard Barnes & Noble or Tower Records, whatever, where can they call or go on the web?
Well, for the Amadou Project, you may call 1-800-468-2646. That's 1-800-468-2646, asking for the Amadou Project. Or you may dial this website, www.usgoldcoins, that's with a S, .com, www.usgoldcoins.com.
After all is said and done, when do we stand or will we just run? Did Medgar Evers die in vain? Have things progressed or do they remain the same? If they can shoot a black man for taking a stand on principle, thinking themselves invincible, making a sham of that word they call justice, how can we trust this? It's time to discuss this.
And again, that number, 1-800-468-2646, so that you don't overwhelm our phones. 1-800-468-2646. Weldon Irvine, thanks for being with us. The CD is The Price of Freedom, The Amadou Project. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette, you can call our archives, Pacifica Archives, at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Will we just run? Young Michael Stewart should not be forgotten. His death a tragedy.